Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 15 days in, the death toll keeps rising. So do the attacks. A massive explosion over Gaza City this morning. More than 600 Gazans killed. More than 25 Israelis have died. Israelis and Palestinians still on the offensive, with no sign of how this will end. Secretary of State John Kerry is in Cairo trying to broker an immediate ceasefire. This hour on Point, mounting alarm over the continued attacks between Israel and the Gaza Strip. Joining me now from Washington by telephone is Ron Dermer, Israeli ambassador to the United States since September 2013. Mr. Ambassador, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me on your show, John.
When we spoke last week, you said that the ground invasion of Gaza was targeted at rocket launching sites and the underground tunnels that Hamas had used to for attacks against Israel. How does the operation compare several days later to what you expected when it started?
It's pretty much what I expected. Just remember, there wouldn't have been a ground operation at all had the Egyptian ceasefire proposal that was proposed about a week ago had it been accepted by Hamas. That proposal was put forward by Egypt. It was accepted by the international community. It was accepted by the Arab League. And it was pushed through the Israeli security cabinet, but by the prime minister. So we wouldn't have had any sort of ground operation. And, of course, before that, we wouldn't have had any air operation because the prime minister said 2 weeks ago, before this whole thing started, that quiet would be met with quiet. And instead, we got 100 rockets fired at us. And after Israel agreed to the ceasefire proposal in the 6 hours that followed, we had dozens of rockets fired at us, and that would force the ground operation, which came about right after also an attempt to infiltrate Israel underneath these tunnels where 13 terrorist commandos came out, and they were trying to slaughter Israeli civilians in a nearby kibbutz and kidnap some of them and take them back into Gaza. So we launched the ground operation largely to take out a lot of these tunnels, and it's a vast, vast infrastructure. People, your listeners should get the videos. They're publicly available at exactly what they have done there in Gaza, these subterranean structures, I call it the terror catacombs, that they have built there and invested enormous amounts of time and money, not to help the people of Gaza, but to build these terror tunnels. And that's what Israel is doing now, operating in Gaza and also taking out missile batteries when we find them.
So, Mr. Ambassador, the level of fatalities, both on the Palestinian side and among the Israeli forces, is not a surprise to you? This is what you expected to happen?
Well, I didn't know. I don't know exactly what we expected, but any time you're engaged in, you know, urban warfare with ground forces, a lot of times civilian casualties will go up in general, and that's true of civilians, particularly when we're dealing with Hamas, that's doing everything possible to put their civilians into harm's way. Remember, the area where there were a lot of casualties, and by the way, we think in this area where most of the fighting is, the majority of them are Hamas fighters. But in that area, there shouldn't have been a single civilian there because Israel dropped flyers, gave people 48 hours to leave, told them where to go, where they would be safe. Unfortunately, Hamas threatened many of them and didn't allow some of them to leave, and they continued to fire from populated areas next to mosques. They used hospitals as command centers, another hospital they fired from. They're using UNRWA schools, UN a UN organization that was established to help Palestinian refugees. They're using the schools to store weapons. I don't know, John, if there's ever been a precedent for this level of the use of human shields that we have now. And that's what's creating the problem in the high civilian casualties, because we're acting to defend ourselves. We're not trying to target their innocence, but they're doing everything to put their innocent civilians into harm's way. And that's part of the problem, and I hope the world will take some sort of stand against Hamas's use of human shields if we don't want this to happen again and again.
There was a story on the front page of the New York Times today about 25 members of several families who were observing Ramadan in a home that was hit with a strike, and many children were killed. That was not at a, so far as I could tell from the story, near any sort of military venue. What's the justification for attacks like that?
Well, I will repeat again. We do not target their civilians. I don't know in this specific case whether there was an operational failure and a missile went into the wrong place, whether there was an intelligence failure that they thought the home was empty, but it wasn't. I don't know the specific facts. I do know there was a case, I think in the first or second day, where there was a Palestinian family in Khan Yunis. I think six or seven people were killed from one family, and that they investigated that. They know exactly what happened there. In that case, we thought that the structure was empty. And one of the things that Israel does, in addition to dropping flyers and text messages and phone calls to get people out of harm's way, is sometimes we will drop what they call sort of a dummy bomb on top of the building that doesn't cause any physical damage. And hopefully, if anyone is in there, then they definitely get out. And what happened in that case was we dropped that bomb. I think the family thought that their house, the bomb had already passed and the house was fine. And they went into the house after we had already fired the second rocket, and that's why that family was killed. So I don't know the specifics of the case. It's a tragedy. Any single time, you're going to have civilian casualties. And Israel, as I said, doesn't target it and sees as a failure the more civilian casualties that you have on the Palestinian side. The difference is Hamas wants to kill as many civilians as possible, and they don't care about their own people, which is why they place these missile batteries what I'm trying to make clear is that on a structural level, as a strategy of warfare, they are placing their missile batteries in areas where there are civilians, and they're building these tunnels in areas of their civilians because they want a situation where their civilians will be killed. That will create, obviously, sympathy, and anyone who sees those pictures, any decent person doesn't want to see women and children and civilians being killed. And they're hoping that those pictures will then lead to pressure on Israel. And if those pictures lead to pressure on Israel, I guarantee you, John, they will continue to use human shields in a more systematic way. If they lead to pressure on Hamas, then the chances of this happening in the future will go down.
Speaking of pressure on Israel, President Obama, of course, has called for a ceasefire. Secretary of State Kerry has traveled to Cairo. How long is Israel prepared to stay the course in the way it's gone the last few days?
Well, as I said, we didn't seek this operation to begin with.
And right, but now that it's underway, how long can Israel sustain this?
Look, what the Prime Minister said is that the objective remains the same, sustain peace and quiet for the people of Israel. We've got a situation where we've got about two-thirds of our population in bomb shelters as they continue to fire over 100 rockets at Israel every day. It's the equivalent of over 200 million Americans sitting in bomb shelters. So what we want is sustain peace and quiet. Whenever we have a proposal, a diplomatic proposal that would deliver that, then that's something, obviously, that the Prime Minister would consider and take through his cabinet. That's what happened time after time. And whenever we had this ceasefire proposal, Israel was the one that accepted it. Unfortunately, Hamas rejected it. The problem right now is that, you know, you have an Egyptian proposal. It's backed by the world. It's backed by the Arab League. The President, Secretary of State, they're all trying to push to end this. The problem is Hamas doesn't seem very interested in ending it, and they continue to fire rockets at Israel.
Let me ask you about two comments that I've come across and get you to respond to them. One was from someone involved in the delivery of social services, an American in the West Bank, who said, how can Israel say that it is trying to minimize civilian casualties when the casualties are simply so high?
Well, it's very simple. When you are facing an enemy that uses human shields systematically uses human shields in the placement of their missile batteries, then even the most just action, the most precision-type actions, they can cause civilian casualties. We've had over 2,000 targeted operations in Gaza. Gaza is a very, very densely populated area. And even if we get it right 99% of the time, if 1% of those actions are wrong, if you have 20 missile strikes that will go to the wrong place in these types of situations of war, you'll have civilian casualties. Look, if Israel were trying to target civilians, you wouldn't have hundreds of civilians of casualties on the Palestinian side. You'd have tens of thousands. We have the ability to kill a lot of civilians. We don't. It's not our policy. And it will continue to not be our policy. And despite the fact we're not fighting a war, and I think it's important for your listeners to understand this, John, we're not fighting a war by remote control thousands of miles away. We're fighting this when our own population is in bomb shelters, and I think Israel has acted with enormous restraint. We haven't been perfect. We've made mistakes. We regret any loss of civilian lives. We're doing everything we can to stop it. But to make these wild accusations of Israel as if Israel is targeting Hamas is just not true. In the war room with the prime minister. I have seen how many operations are called off, legitimate military operations that are called off, because we see civilians come into harm's way. I wish that would be the case on the other side, but they're actually trying to target and kill as many Israeli civilians as possible.
I'm going to put two things to you because I know our time is short. One is Hanan Ashrawi, the PLO veteran, was on ABC last night and turned around the question that you posed last week, which is what nation could tolerate indiscriminate rocket fire into its territory? She said, what people could tolerate the living conditions imposed on people living in Gaza? That's A. And then B, is there an Israeli soldier now being held captive by Hamas, do you believe?
Well, the second one is we don't think so as of yet, but, you know, we're checking. We have a lot of soldiers in the field, and they're determining whether that's true. I don't have any information that it is true at this point. As for what Mrs. Ashrawi said, look, she is relying on the fact that most people's sense of history goes back to breakfast. Because in 2005, Israel left Gaza. We did exactly what the international community wanted. Go back to the 67 lines, uproot all the settlements, and instead of turning Gaza around, instead of giving hope to the Palestinian people and giving them a better future, Hamas took over the Gaza Strip and then succeeded in investing all that money.
Ambassador Dermer, I know we've got to let you go. Thanks for joining us. I'm John Harwood in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm John Harwood in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the growing conflict between Hamas and Israel, the mounting death toll, and prospects for a resolution. Joining us now from Washington is Aaron David Miller, Vice President for New Initiatives and Distinguished Scholar at the Middle East Program at the Wilson Center. He spent two decades in the State Department, where he helped formulate U.S. policy on the Middle East and the Arab-Israel peace process. His forthcoming book, The End of Greatness, Why America Can't Have and Doesn't Want Another Great President. Also from Washington, Yousef Munayyer, Executive Director of the Jerusalem Fund and its educational program, the Palestine Center, which focuses on Palestinian issues. And from Tel Aviv, Shlomo Brom, director of the program on Israeli-Palestinian relations at Tel Aviv University's Institute for National Security Studies. He's former deputy to Israel's National Security Advisor and a retired brigadier general. Thanks to all for joining us. Aaron David Miller, let me start with you. You just heard the ambassador say that Israel has attempted to refine its targeting, has not targeted civilians, but casualties are inevitable when they're used as human shields. Does he have a point?
You know, the reality is Israel's technological capability judged to be so superior that any operational failures or incompetence which results in the deaths of civilians, particularly in densely populated areas, is somehow automatically viewed as an intentional act to target and kill civilians. I mean, I think there are a number of illusions here. The Israelis may go to extreme lengths to warn, to limit the number of civilian casualties, but there is no way that you can operate in this kind of environment, particularly even without the notion of human shields, even when targets and rockets, tunnels, Hamas operatives are co-located or close to civilian areas. There's no way you're going to be able to operate in a sort of pinpoint fashion, to use John Kerry's rather sarcastic comment on the hot mic yesterday, and not have tremendous civilian casualties. And the longer this goes on, the more likely that that is going to happen. The other reality is that the asymmetry of casualties, the fact that 27 Israeli soldiers have been killed, a couple of Israeli civilians as a consequence of Iron Dome, in some respects, prepositions Israel very poorly in the other conflict, quote-unquote. Remember, there's the military conflict over tactics and strategy. Then there's the image conflict of who is ultimately going to emerge from this latest round of the Israel-Hamas confrontation in the best political shape. And the asymmetry of casualties, combined with the numbers of largely civilian casualties, creates a huge challenge. And the perception that Israel is grossly violating every conceivable standard of human rights and international law. And I think that the situation, as cruel and as tragic as it is, and it's cruel in large part because the end of this conflict and confrontation is not going to produce a solution. It'll produce an outcome which conceivably could buy some time and space. But for the vast majority of people of Gazans, this is simply of Gaza. This is going to be a respite, frankly, until the next round.
Yousef Munayyer, what is your reaction to the ambassador's comments this morning?
Well, thanks, John, and thanks for having me. If I could, as the only Palestinian voice of the four that are participating in this program, just respond to some of the very thick propaganda that was laid down in the beginning quarter of this conversation. In regards to human shields, this is an allegation that we have heard from the Israelis on numerous occasions in the past. We heard it in 2008, 2009, during what they called Operation Cast Lead that ultimately left over 1,400 Palestinians dead, most of whom were civilians. In the aftermath of that, Amnesty International undertook a major investigation and produced a 100-page report in which they noted that there was no evidence whatsoever of the use of human shields from the Palestinian side, but in fact, Israeli soldiers on the ground were found to have been using Palestinian civilians as human shields. So I think we need to consider the source whenever we hear the kind of allegations that we do about human shields from the Israeli ambassador. On the issue of dummy bombs, you know, the notion that these sort of warning missiles don't injure anybody is completely ludicrous. There were just four Palestinian boys who were killed by one of these so-called harmless dummy bombs in the Gaza Strip just the other day. On the notion that they ask civilians to move, again, you know, we have seen documented in the Gaza Strip, for example, Palestinians from the Maghazi and Burej camps being told to move to Deir el-Balah just yesterday. And subsequently, the Israelis carried out bombing campaigns in the towns in which they were told to move. There is really no safe place in Gaza. So this notion that, you know, you've told civilians to move to someplace safe is very disingenuous, particularly when, you know, the Israelis are closing off an exit to the Gaza Strip from which civilians could leave if a safe passage was made available, but it's not being made available. On this notion that they did not seek this operation, you know, this was preceded by a massive collective punishment campaign in the West Bank that targeted Palestinians. And this idea that Israel left Gaza, you know, Israel continues to control the Gaza Strip, whether it has settlers there or not. It controls the coastal ports. It controls the entry and exit ports. It controls imports and exports, what goes in, what goes out. It controls the population registry in the Gaza Strip. The notion that, you know, Israel doesn't control the Gaza Strip just because it doesn't have settlers there is akin to the notion that one does not control the life of a fish in their house because they don't swim in the fishbowl. And finally, on this, you know, overemphasis on Hamas, the reality is on the ground is there are multiple combatants here on the Palestinian side. This is not just Hamas. This is Hamas. This is Islamic Jihad. This is the Fatah-affiliated Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade. This is the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine. There is a wide spectrum of Palestinian parties that are acting out in resistance to what is the massive collective punishment of Palestinian civilians in the Gaza Strip. That is the underlying context here, which I know the ambassador would like to avoid. But we cannot expect the collective punishment of 1.5 million people to simply be acceptable. I mean, what nation on earth would accept that?
Shlomo Brom, collective punishment of the Palestinian people, is that in fact the cause of this conflict?
Well, it's very typical that the one that uses only propaganda is blaming the others as using propaganda. What I heard in the last couple of minutes was pure propaganda. Completely not based on facts. Well, Israel this time organized very well to document everything. So we have videos, we have pictures of everything. we can show rocket launches in schools, in mosques, 1 meter from an hospital. All this is documented. So my distinguished Palestinian friend can tell any story he wants, but it's baseless. And you know the excuse that it's not Hamas, there are different gangs or different groups, is a very poor excuse, because Hamas is still the government of the Gaza Strip. And maybe I am wrong, but I think that the government is responsible for the territory it controls. Who controls militarily the Gaza Strip? Israel or Hamas? Who threw out the legitimate government of the Palestinian Authority from the Gaza Strip? Did we do it or Hamas did it? So I suggest that instead of being engaged in propaganda, let us talk of ways we can stop this terrible fighting.
Well, Aaron David Miller, on that point, what is the way to stop the fighting? You wrote a piece recently arguing that the time was right for this conflict because of the different political and military clocks that were ticking. What can stop it? And who are the interlocutors who can help the United States make that happen?
I mean, this is the third round, significant round between Israel and Hamas. The first ended after 3 weeks in a unilateral Israeli ceasefire. It was preceded by a UN Security Council resolution, which the U.S. abstained. The second ended as a consequence of an Egyptian brokered ceasefire, which has again appeared in the views of some parties, to be the basis for a settlement. Or at least a ceasefire. Look, my view of this, and I don't want to be heartless or cruel, you need three things to bring this to an end. You need urgency. And when I say urgency, I don't mean to trivialize or dismiss the pain and the suffering, however asymmetrical it may be, that is being visited on the Palestinian public in Gaza and the Israeli public. But you don't have the kind of urgency that is required with respect to the main actors. And urgency is driven by pain and gain. I do not believe, frankly, that Hamas is done, and I'm not sure that the Israelis have finished what they believe to be their discrete mission. So that's number one, urgency. Number two, you need a mediator. You need a mediator or mediators, plural, that have the trust and confidence of both sides and can function effectively. And there's much more confusion among mediators in this round than there was in November of 2012. And finally, let's be clear, you need a deal. And you're going to have a deal. But the deal is going to have to involve, I suspect, very difficult choices on the part of Hamas and Israel. Now, Israel is a unitary decision maker. There's no question about that, despite political constraints. It is curious, and I'm not sure we know, I don't know, who in fact is making the key decisions in Gaza right now. Because it seems to me that a younger generation of military commanders, who I think are to some degree reveling in their successes so far, may well not be interested right now in bringing this to an end. And in fact, their demands may increase. But even if that is not the case, it's going to be very difficult this time around to get a clean ceasefire, which is what the Egyptians and the Israelis want, a clean ceasefire, even though phase two would have to bring into play a number of elements, political and economic elements on the Palestinian side, and a number perhaps of security elements on the Israeli side in order to get something more durable. One additional point. If, in fact, an Israeli has been captured or killed in Gaza and Hamas has him or his remains, then I think you've added another layer of complexity to this negotiation, which is going to make it even more difficult, it seems to me, to resolve. So in conclusion,
difficulty is the theme, Aaron David Miller.
Right. Egypt will be the driver of this train, but it's going to have to rely on others in order to bring this to fruition.
Our phone lines are lighting up. Let's go to a call from John in Ann Arbor, Michigan. John, welcome to the show, and what's your question?
John, thank you for taking my call. Israel's response to the Gaza situation this time is not proportional. If it were, Israel's goal has to be the removal of Hamas from Gaza, followed by active Israeli working with the people of Gaza to develop a viable economic entity. My question is, why is Netanyahu, like Putin, so incapable of thinking strategically in such matters?
Shlomo?
I believe that in most of the places of the world we suffer of political leaders that are so concerned about the re-elections and the immediate future that it's very difficult for them to think strategically when they have to be engaged all the time in keeping the government in the short term. But concerning the suggestion that the listener made, I think that Israel, whether it is strategic thinking or it's not strategic thinking, would like to see Hamas out of Gaza and to work with the Gaza population. But the only way that I know of doing it is by reoccupying the whole of the Gaza Strip and staying there for several years to get rid of Hamas. And that's something that Israel has no interest in doing. The cost is too high. We don't want to reoccupy the Gaza Strip.
Youssef, I want to read to you a remark from one of our listeners on Facebook, Meredith Hassan, and she said, "Do you not realize that Hamas intends to destroy Jews, starting in Israel and then in the world? What does that sound like? When will we learn from history?" What's your response?
Let me just say first, and I think this is part of the discussion that we're having about a way forward. I think the notion of what's going on now versus reoccupation is really a false choice. We have seen in more than one instance in the past, during an Egyptian brokered ceasefire, both in June of 2008 and after November of 2012, the quietest periods that Israel has ever experienced in the projectile era from the Gaza Strip. It is, in fact, ceasefire agreements that provide more sustainable quiet for Israel than anything else. What's needed is ceasefires that are not just agreed to by both sides, but where both sides can actually be held accountable. Because I think one thing that's missing in this discussion is that when there are ceasefires, when there is an end to projectile fire from the Gaza Strip, there's no end to the system of violence that is the Israeli siege on the Gaza Strip that is enforced, in fact, by fire from naval forces and from ground forces as well.
Youssef Mounayer, please hold that thought. Shlomo Brown and Aaron David Miller, you too. We're discussing the attacks on Israel and Gaza, the mounting death toll, efforts to end the conflict. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the attacks in Gaza and Israel and the efforts to reach a ceasefire. I want to start by playing some remarks from President Obama yesterday in the Oval Office when he was speaking about concern about civilian deaths and the need to focus on achieving a sustainable ceasefire.
Israel has a right to defend itself against rocket and tunnel attacks from Hamas. And as a result of its operations, Israel has already done significant damage to Hamas's terrorist infrastructure in Gaza. I've also said, however, that we have serious concerns about the rising number of Palestinian civilian deaths and the loss of Israeli lives.
Youssef Munayyer, how do you evaluate the United States' response to the conflict so far?
Well, I think, unfortunately, you know, the serious concern is not going to do too much for the 500 or so Palestinians that had died by that point. You know, a week before that, President Obama had spoke with the Israeli prime minister and offered to facilitate a ceasefire, when instead at that point, I think the United States should really have been demanding one. And at that point, you know, the Palestinian side had already offered ceasefire terms that went ignored by the Israelis in the early stages of this. So I think, you know, the role that the United States is playing in just providing a sort of carte blanche for the Israelis to carry out a campaign that we all know is not going to significantly change the reality between Israel and Gaza, save for the fact that hundreds of Palestinians, overwhelmingly whom will be civilians, will have died. The absence of real American leadership and providing the Israelis with the ability to do what is frankly not going to help anybody at all, and especially hurt the Palestinians, I think is very troubling.
Shlomo Brom, does Israel see a green light from Washington?
Well, I think that Israel understands, that Washington understands that Israel has to defend itself. And as long as the other side, Hamas and the other militant groups, insist on continuing the fire, Israel will have to respond accordingly. Now, Mr. Munayyer, definition of the Palestinian side is very strange, because to the best of my knowledge, the legitimate Palestinian government is the government in Ramallah. That was even affirmed by the agreement between Hamas and Fatah on establishment of a national unity government. Now, the conditions that Mr. Munayyer is talking about were not presented by the legitimate Palestinian government. They were presented by a rogue organization, Hamas. Actually, Israel accepted the Egyptian offer. And the Egyptian offer of a ceasefire and conditions for ceasefire are the ones that are agreed by Egypt, by the Palestinian government in Ramallah, by Israel, by most of the other Arab actors in the Middle East. But from the point of view of Mr. Munayyer, probably Hamas is the Palestinian side.
Aaron David Miller, Shlomo Brom was talking about the Egyptian ceasefire proposal. Is Egypt disabled from effectively brokering talks because of its bad relationship with Hamas? And if that's the case, what is the role of other countries, Turkey, Qatar, in helping to achieve some sort of solution?
Well, to some degree, Egypt's change in relationship with Hamas does inhibit its capacity. But let's be clear. Hamas is also fundamentally dependent on Egypt. Rafah, which is the largest single pedestrian crossing from Gaza into Egypt, is controlled by the Egyptians. The Egyptians control the tunnel trade, both with respect to contraband and not contraband, which has been extremely lucrative and necessary, and not just for Hamas's contraband, but for local goods for Gazans. No, Egypt is a critical player, and frankly, as Hamas's relationship with Egypt has deteriorated, paradoxically, Egypt's relationship, or perhaps understandably, Egypt's relationship with Israel has, in fact, gotten closer. So Egypt will insist, I think, on the dominant role, and they will want to limit the role of others, including Turkey and Qatar. Now, the Qataris may well have to be brought into this to pay salaries. Those are the salaries of roughly 43,000 Hamas employees who haven't been paid. That would probably constitute something like $20 million a month. So this is going to be a collective exercise, perhaps assembled in a formal way by John Kerry, with the Egyptians being the driver. One additional point though. Shlomo Brom raises a very intriguing and necessary point. We've gone now for almost an hour in this conversation, and there was no mention of the Palestinian Authority, the duly constituted government. And I find it almost remarkable. I mean, in part, it reflects the marginalization of Mr. Abbas during these sorts of confrontations, when in fact he is and has presented himself as a legitimate negotiating partner, I think a well-intentioned negotiating partner for Israel. And we focused almost exclusively on Hamas. Now, it may well be that Hamas is now the address. When you want a ceasefire, you go to Hamas, not Abbas. When you want your prisoners back, you go to Hamas, not Abbas. But I think it's a dangerous sort of point of departure to take, because in the end, Hamas cannot be and will not be without a profound transformation in both its ideology and its tactics.
Youssef Munayyer,
a part of this, and just one additional point, unity is phony unity. If unity really meant one gun, one authority, one negotiating position, it would be worth pursuing. But right now you have a Palestine that looks like Noah's Ark. Literally, there are two of everything. Two sets of security services, two statelets, two constitutions, and two different visions of where Palestine is and what it is. And that unity is a basic disunity, has to be turned into unity if there's ever going to be, on the Palestinian side, a interlocutor that can maintain one gun, one authority, one negotiating position.
Youssef Munayyer, before I go to calls, which I'm going to do in a moment, just respond about the absence of Abbas from this discussion, as Aaron David Miller just mentioned. Should he have a greater role? Can he have a greater role?
Well, I think it is an important issue, not just when it comes to what's going on now in Gaza, but in the broader context of you know, Palestinian representation. You know, Palestinians cannot choose who makes up the Israeli government, and outsiders can really not choose who makes up a Palestinian government. And any successful agreement to the Israeli-Palestinian issue in general is going to rely on Palestinians being represented by legitimate representatives. Unfortunately, the policies over the last, 10 to 20 years in particular have created this incentive structure that have marginalized and undercut the so-called moderates that the United States and the Israelis claim that they want to support in Abbas, while empowering those who they seek to marginalize. And you have to call into question whether or not the strategy behind all of this is simply to keep Palestinians divided so as to continue expanding into and controlling their territory.
All right, let's go to our phone lines. We've got listeners waiting. Stuart is on the phone from Omaha, Nebraska. Stuart, welcome to the show. What's your question?
Hi, John. First of all, Youssef is the one making the most sense here. I'd like to cut to the chase here. This is a national security issue for the United States. This conflict is one of the reasons that Arabs and Muslims hate the United States. This has been going on for 60-some years, and this is the reason why it has to stop, and it will not stop until the U.S. Gets engaged. And because we have such a dysfunctional Congress, I can't really see much of a future there. Let's look at this thing in context. Israel has never cared much for Palestinian life or life in general. When they invaded Lebanon, they killed about 30,000 people in Lebanon. Beit Salem, the Human Rights Committee in Israel, reports all kinds of abuses. We know the Sabra Shatila massacres, et cetera, et cetera. To even talk of a peace process is literally absurd when you have one side with F-16s and tanks and the only superpower in the world on one side, and in an impoverished, desperate people with rocks on the other side.
Stuart, thanks so much for your call. Shlomo, Brom, what's your response to Stuart?
Well, it is clear that the caller dislikes Israel. And so he started with the usual accumulation of blames, some blames that Israel deserves, some that it doesn't deserve, I always smile when I hear that Israelis are blamed for when Arabs are killing Arabs by the same people that probably don't care what is going on around in the Arab world, with all these terrible numbers of people that are killed in inter-Arab fighting. But let's leave history and let's deal with the problem at hand. I am a great believer in the idea that crisis situations also present opportunities. And I think that this crisis presents an opportunity to do something that maybe even this caller will like. And that is to try to use it as a way to bring back the Palestinian Authority to the to the Gaza Strip, using the reconciliation agreement, which I agree with Ambassador Miller. So far, it is a fake agreement, but I think that gradually it can be developed into something that is more real. But for that, both Israel and I think the United States has to change their approach towards this agreement, and instead of looking at it as a threat, looking at it as an opportunity to stop the present problematic situation of two so-called separate Palestinian entities, to reunite them and to start a process that may bring about maybe some changes even in Hamas.
Shlomo, you made the point a crisis is an opportunity. Let's hear from another caller on the line. We've got Joe from Oklahoma City. Joe, welcome to the show. Go ahead.
Hi, John. It appears from mid-America that the Arabs can't get along with anyone in general, not just the United States. They can't get along with each other. They keep talking and throwing the rocks, as the previous caller said, with missiles attached at Israel. They're lucky they haven't been just stomped by Israel. That's what should happen. It's going to continue until they decide that they can live peacefully. Then they will get their own territory. Thank you.
Thanks, Joe. Youssef Munayer, the caller just said that Palestinians are lucky they haven't been stomped by Israel. What's your response?
Well, I mean, obviously, I think the notion that Arabs are somehow inherently more violent than anyone else, particularly after, you know, the last century in which we witnessed massive butchering of human beings, primarily among Europeans in major world wars, is not only inaccurate, but there's something of a racism involved there as well. But you know, when it comes to the Palestinians in particular, yes, they're not going to sit quiet in the face of persistent occupation and siege, which has now been going on for decades. And not see any progress through a diplomatic process, which has only brought forward continued Israeli settlements, and not see any progress on any other fronts and sit there and accept it. I mean, it is unreasonable to expect the kind of compliance with that system of oppression from Palestinians or any people around the world. So until that fundamental underlying reality changes, we can only expect to see more of these episodes happen. And you know, I would just make a point here on this notion of the Palestinian Authority coming to Gaza. This is precisely the kind of analysis that's so devoid of an understanding of Palestinian domestic politics that leads one to think that bringing the Palestinian Authority and Mahmoud Abbas back to the Gaza Strip on the back of Israeli tanks and in the wake of this massacre in the Gaza Strip is somehow helping him, gain legitimacy among the Palestinian people. I mean, this is nonsense. And so I think, you know, you have to let Palestinians have self-determination, elect their own leaders, and not try to shape the contours of their leadership because you simply don't like the legitimate grievances that they have.
Youssef Munayyer joining us from Washington, Shlomo Brown from Tel Aviv, Aaron David Miller from Washington. Thanks so much for being with us. I want to go out with a little bit of sound to remind us of exactly what's at stake here. Here's a Palestinian describing the violence.
I was crying and shouting, Madia Abdul Atta told us. I saw bodies spread on the streets. I have never seen such a terrible thing.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Coming up tomorrow, crisis at the U.S. border, special roundtable. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.